Okay, our now on to our next order of business of the day, which is case 21-1871, Levi Strauss versus Aqua Dynamics. Please come forward. Mr. Michaels, please proceed. If you wish, you may take your mask off.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Michaels, right here. I have hearing injuries from too many years on the water listening to big guns from the Navy, so would you please be sure to speak up?
Yes, Your Honor. I'd be delighted to. And if I happen to forget, please remind me. May it please the Court, and good morning. My name is Jimmy Michaels, and I'm appearing here today on behalf of Aqua Dynamics Systems, Inc. This was a real treat to see the swearing in today. If I would have known that type of ceremony happened, I might have wanted to appear in person for my motion to appear before this court.
We probably would have denied it. We only do it for law.
It was also a real treat to hear Judge Plager utter the word vacatur before the argument even started. Before we do get started, I just want to thank you for the opportunity to present oral argument this morning. And I understand that the court is familiar with the briefs and the law, and so I'd like to just cut right through to what Judge Orrick at the Northern District characterized as the heart of the dispute, and which is an opinion that I share, and I believe counsel for Levi shares it too, which is, were the undisclosed business dealings between JAMS on the one hand, and Levi's on the other hand, trivial or non-trivial? If they were trivial in this court's view, then Levi's should win the day. If they were non-trivial in this court's view, which is certainly our view, and we believe it's the view of the Ninth Circuit, and we believe it's the only view that is appropriate in light of the guidance provided by the Supreme Court in the Ninth Circuit.
Where do we draw the line? I mean, how many, you know, obviously with respect to after Monster, all of these owners of JAMS have an issue, have a problem. So the question is one prior case enough? In other words, is there ever a trivial relationship that these owners could have?
In a hypothetical world, yes, mm-hmm. I can think of trivial cases that they could have.
Okay,
if
like
one
that.
Of the arbitrators 7 years ago had bought a pair of Levi's jeans at Macy's and didn't disclose that because he had forgotten that that was one of the 20 brands of jeans in his closet, I could see that being trivial. But when we're talking about entrusting an arbitrator or a mediator, whatever the case may be, with determining legal rights and obligations, resolving legal conflicts, that is a matter that should be disclosed.
Let's answer Judge O'Malley's question, a good question, in two steps. Step number one is it your view that any time an arbitrator is what they call an owner with 0.1% possibility of getting money, which is standard in the industry, at least as far as this particular company, arbitration company, is concerned. Is it your view that that's per se a grounds for disqualification?
In the hypothetical that you present, if there is an argument.
No, it's not a hypothetical, it's a simple question. The simple question is the fact that an arbitrator happens to work with JAMS automatically disqualifying?
An arbitrator who is an owner of JAMS.
Yes.
When JAMS has had prior.
Of which many judges and many of the arbitrators are owners, apparently. I'm not quite clear. Perhaps you know exactly when you become an owner and when you don't. But put that aside. Is it your view that the very fact that the arbitrator has quote, ownership interest, which is apparently a standard interest, that automatically disqualifies the arbitrator?
It does not automatically disqualify the arbitrator.
So that's first, not a disqualification in and of itself.
Well, if it were properly...
That's a yes or no. That's not a disqualification in and of itself.
Yes, Your Honor. I agree with that.
Then what did these arbitrators, everybody involved who deals with arbitrators, know who these people work for? They all work through JAMS. They don't really work for JAMS, but they work through JAMS. So what did these people do wrong other than reveal the fact that they are JAMS arbitrators, which everybody do, and including your client who wanted them? And what else should they have done? What did they do wrong?
There is a distinction between JAMS arbitrators and JAMS owner arbitrators.
Had they made that distinction, that would have disqualified them.
No, Your Honor. Had they made that disclosure back when they made their original disclosures at the outset of the arbitration, then both parties, including my client, could have made a fully informed decision about whether they wanted to proceed.
Are you telling me that your client and the lawyers who represented your client had no understanding of how the arbitration business worked? Is that what you're telling us?
There was no disclosure that those...
Are you telling us that without some detailed disclosure of their exact dollar income through JAMS, that your client and its lawyers could not possibly know that these arbitrators have an interest that they get money from working through JAMS?
They couldn't have known about the particular type of income stream that was coming to them. It was this, as eventually disclosed by JAMS, they receive a share of the profits of JAMS on a yearly basis.
All the owners do, and apparently a third of all arbitrators are owners. Is that what we understand?
It's somewhere in between a quarter and a third, yes.
Somewhere.
So you didn't know until Monster came out?
That's correct, Judge O'Malley. The interim award was issued, and very shortly thereafter, Monster came out. After Monster came out, JAMS, in a big hurry, sent supplemental disclosures that revealed significantly more past business dealings between JAMS and Levi's than had been disclosed in the first place.
And so when they did the first disclosure, they didn't disclose the ownership interest, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And when they did the first disclosure, they disclosed only some prior dealings.
That's exactly correct, Your Honor. When they did the initial disclosure, the arbitrators disclosed each individual arbitrator's prior dealings. We then learned that two of those arbitrators were actually owners of JAMS. Under Commonwealth Codings, under the Schmitz case from the Ninth Circuit, under New Regency, the overall business dealings of the organization that they were an owner of had to be disclosed. They were not until after Monster came out.
You know, I was actually kind of shocked when the Monster case came out because I had no idea that some of these arbitrators were actually owners of JAMS and that they weren't disclosing that to people. So why is it? I was almost as shocked that the Ninth Circuit just didn't set down a hard and fast rule that says the owner arbitrators can't be arbitrators without full disclosure. So, but they didn't.
I agree with your shock and surprise, which Judge Friedland shared in the dissent. On further reflection, well, it's been about 2 years since Monster, and our research hasn't shown a single arbitration was vacated under Monster, after Monster. And that's actually not that surprising to me because it's a really particular set of circumstances that led to Vacatur and Monster that I don't think has been present in any of the other post-Monster cases, but is present here. First of all, you're dealing with an arbitration organization that is owned by the arbitrators. Think about the other big arbitration organizations out there, AAA, a nonprofit. FINRA, quasi-governmental entity. JAMS, as far as I know, fits into a very small minority of those types of organizations. Then, only looking at the Ninth Circuit, which has a different rubric for evident partiality, then you have to hit a case where there actually were prior business dealings. then that case has to involve one of the one-quarter to one-third of arbitrators who are owner arbitrators. So it's actually rather small. You know, once you whittle it down, get to the bottom of the funnel, it's this very small group of cases you're dealing with. And that's what happened in Monster, and that's what happened here.
How many arbitrations did GMs do for Levi's?
So what was eventually disclosed was that in about the 9 years before, about 9 years, 10 months before Monster Energy came down.
You can call it 10 years.
Fair enough, Judge Plager. In that period of time, there was one court reference, which Judge Oreck correctly treated as an arbitration, and which I don't think there is grounds to change his mind there. Judge Oreck treated it as an arbitration, so there's one of those and six mediations for a total of seven interactions. Counsel has recently raised the idea that perhaps one of those mediations was double counted, but what Judge Oreck saw was six and one.
Certainly smaller numbers than Monster dealt with. Monster dealt with, like, 97.
That's absolutely right. Monster far surpassed whatever threshold there is.
Let me ask you, had you finished, or did you have a further question?
So I guess I wanted to ask you, with only one arbitration, and it seems quite clear that the district court found that the arbitration is something that from which the company would derive more money, takes more time, is more involved, and it makes sense because you're actually rendering a decision as distinct from a mediation where you're just facilitating the parties trying to reach a decision. One arbitration in 10 years, the lower court found that in conjunction with the mediations to be trivial. Is that correct?
Yes.
Is that a question of fact?
We're not here to dispute.
Is it a question of fact?
No.
Of course it is. Yes, of course it is. How could it not be?
It is a question of the legal significance of those facts. We don't dispute.
That's just application of law to fact, then.
We don't dispute.
It's a question of fact, counsel. What is my standard of review for a question of fact?
The standard of review for question of fact is clear error.
Right. So how can I say the lower court clearly erred when he found that one arbitration in nearly a decade is trivial?
The way that the Ninth Circuit evaluated this very issue in Monster Energy was on a de novo basis, because the Ninth Circuit found that what they were interpreting was the facts of the 97 arbitrations in Monster were not in dispute.
The Ninth Circuit set out the standard. That was the de novo part. They set out the two-part test in Monster. That's the de novo part, right?
I believe that the standard of review that the Ninth Circuit looked at was...
Show me where that's the case in Monster.
We look at page one. I can provide a pin site. Jurisdiction and standard of review on 1133. We review de novo the district court's confirmation of the arbitration.
Ultimate conclusion. Correct. That's the ultimate conclusion.
I would posit that the ultimate conclusion is the legal conclusion that was drawn from the undisputed facts of the 97 arbitration.
So the Ninth Circuit laid out a two-part test. Step one is whether the arbitrator's ownership interest in GMs was sufficiently substantial. Do you think that's a question of fact?
I think that the facts there are that there are...
I didn't ask you what you think the facts are. I asked if you think it's a question of fact. Is it?
Yes.
So according to you, the Ninth Circuit laid out a two-part test for determining this level of partiality that requires vacatur. Step one is whether or not the ownership interest in GMs was sufficiently substantial. You can see that's a question of fact. So if that were the inquiry in front of us, which it's not, we'd have to review that inquiry for clear error, correct?
Your Honor, I'm sorry. I may have gotten my words tangled. I believe that is a question. The question of whether an ownership interest is substantial is a question of law. On the record that we have, we know the fact of what that ownership interest is, which is an equal ownership share that is shared by one quarter to one third of the arbitrators at GMs. But whether that rises to the threshold of substantial or not is a question of law, just as whether the business dealings, which we agree on, rise to the threshold of non-trivial is a matter of law.
Do you have any support for that statement? because I don't agree with you. I don't think that's accurate. Whether or not something is substantial has not usually been the kind of thing we say is a legal question. Likewise, whether something is trivial or non-trivial is not the kind of thing that usually is a legal question that judges ought to be deciding de novo on appeal. Those feel like quintessential fact questions to me by the nature of the articulation of their particular tests. And so I'd like to know if you have any support for your thinking that it's not just the ultimate legal question that is de novo reviewed, but rather all subsidiary questions as well to the inquiry.
Your Honor, I think that reviewing the Commonwealth Codings case, reviewing the Schmitz case, reviewing the New Regency case, all of which in which arbitration awards were vacated after having been issued on the grounds of there being business dealings between the parties and an entity owned by one of the arbitrator. And I think looking at those in conjunction with the Lagstein case and then the Sussex case, which was in the district court briefing but did not appear in the briefing before the appellate court here today, I think looking at those, you see that the way that the Ninth Circuit and, in one instance, the Supreme Court treated the analysis was by taking the undisputed facts. The facts really were not under dispute in any of those matters, in deciding whether they met the legal thresholds.
It, certainly the Ninth Circuit has said that certain circumstances are substantial as a matter of law, right?
Like 97 arbitration, yes.
Well, no, like the ownership interest.
Yes.
And in Schmitz, which I think is distinguishable to some extent, they said as a matter of law, where you actually represented a party, that is substantial. So I get your point that it can rise to the level of being substantial or being even non-trivial as a matter of law, depending upon the scope of the facts. In other words, just like summary judgment, sometimes there are lots of underlying facts, but they're not important to the ultimate conclusion. But here, the second prong, the triviality prong, that's the one that I think Judge Moore wants you to focus on in terms of isn't whether something is trivial a question of fact until basically it blows up so that there can be no dispute. You know, where does the district court have any kind of discretion in ultimately deciding triviality?
Once you start looking at repeat players, once the fact of a repeat player is established, and that's something the Ninth Circuit found important in Monster, I don't know that they found it dispositive, but they found it important. I think at that point, you're looking at a matter of law.
Going back to Judge Moore's earlier question, is there a difference between a repeat player for arbitrations, which brings in a lot more money, or a repeat player for mediations?
I think that in any of these analyses, what's important is the financial relationship, not necessarily the nature of the legal rights that are being adjudicated or resolved by that relationship.
Is it in the record the actual dollar amounts that JAMS earned from these relationships?
No, it's not, Your Honor. We have some indicia pointing us in that direction. We know from an attachment to the district court briefing, the JAMS fees range from $450 to $800 per hour and $4,000 to $8,000 per day. That's Exhibit 12 to the McFarland Declaration with the motion to vacate from the district court briefing. We know that in the arbitration at issue here, the total fees were about $140,000. No matter how you slice this, the amount of money at stake far surpasses the $12,000 that were at stake, albeit in 1968 dollars, in Commonwealth Codings, when the U.S. Supreme Court said that type of relationship will be debated here. You see a similar fact pattern in the other Ninth Circuit cases too. The thresholds, the 19 cases over 35 years, in New Regency, the negotiation. When you look at those numbers, the numbers in our case far surpass those. 7 matters over 10 years is a higher proportion than 19 over 35. 6 mediations and 1 arbitration would lead to fees far greater than the $12,000 in Commonwealth Codings. And then you look at the cases where the courts refuse to vacate or refuse to disqualify an arbitrator under this standard, and the connection between the business organization owned by the arbitrator and the party is far less substantial. And I would direct you to the Lagstein in the Sussex case, which is 781 F3rd 1065 out of the Ninth Circuit in 2015.
You are way over your time, counsel.
Yes, I was going to.
Opposing counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. Monster Energy was a case about repeat player bias. And it was of such a magnitude that disclosure was required. And Monster Energy was a repeat player because it had a forum contract that compelled each of its vendors to arbitrate any dispute between them at JAMS in Orange County, California. And pursuant to that contract, Monster Energy compelled the other party in that case to participate in that arbitration. Here, the facts could not be more starkly different. Here, Levi's did not want to have this arbitration. Levi's litigated for over a year trying to prevent this arbitration from happening. Levi's actually filed the declaratory judgment action in the district court to enjoin the arbitration and was ultimately unsuccessful and was compelled to participate in that arbitration.
But does that really matter? I mean, we're talking about disclosures.
We're talking about the disclosure, but the issue that is at key in the Ninth Circuit decision is to address the bias created by a repeat player. And in Aqua Dynamics briefing, they say that Judge Ware and Judge Brazil were susceptible to an incentive to reward LS&Co. for past loyalty and to lure it back for future engagements with the dispute. And so here there was no past loyalty to reward. Levi's had had minimal contact with JAMS that had not been disclosed.
But, I mean, what about luring them back? I mean, I do find this whole notion that these are owners of this entity and that yet that they hold themselves out as neutrals to be pretty offensive. And, you know, Levi's is a big company and probably will have a lot of disputes. So why wouldn't the very incentive to keep Levi's happy be enough?
Well, the theory of Monster Energy was to prevent repeat player bias based on past contacts.
But you just quoted that they also talked about luring them back for future contacts.
Well, I think that that would apply to any company. To any company.
Certainly any large company that might have repeated disputes.
Yes. And that goes back to the concern of Justice White in the Commonwealth Coatings case that you can basically disqualify the most qualified arbitrators by placing the burden here too low to disqualify them. Because two retired federal district court judges would be disqualified from this case, would be then disqualified from arbitrating any matter with a major company. So you would disqualify that entire layer of arbitrators from JAMS.
Just those arbitrators who are owners.
And we don't have disclosure from JAMS of who that entire body is. It's between a third and a quarter. And we know that the two federal judges, or retired federal judges in our case were. We know that the retired federal judge in the Monster Energy case were. So it appears to affect retired judges.
Yeah, just retired judges who don't understand that you shouldn't have a conflict of interest.
Well, in this case, if you're looking at the repeat player bias, the disclosures from JAMS at the inception of the arbitration were that JAMS had, that Judge Ware, who was a panelist in this case, had in fact mediated a case for Levi's. And so he was involved in that case. One of the panelists was involved in that case, so took the fee as a panelist in that case. Aside from that one that was disclosed, the only prior dealings in the prior 5 years with Levi Strauss was one mediation and one court appointment. So over the preceding 5 years, which is what the time period that Monster Energy looked at, there was one mediation and one court appointment. And there's nothing in the
record. Right, but if I'm a lawyer, and you know, the question is a conflict. If Judge Moore and Judge Plager are my partners, then anything that they did creates a conflict for me, right?
In a law firm, yes, and that's the Schmitz case because of the duties
right,
of
so
fidelity.
Why is this not different? I mean, why is this different?
In two reasons here. One is in terms of what the scope of the neutrals responsibilities are in a mediation. They're not the party who's deciding the case. They're the party who are trying to broker the deal between the two parties. And Judge Orrick found that distinction meaningful. In the Monster Energy case itself, the record to the Ninth Circuit made reference to 17 mediations that Monster Energy had had before JAMS, and the Ninth Circuit did not even mention those in its briefing. They did not feel that, or in their opinion, they did not feel that those mediations were relevant enough to include in the opinion. They only mentioned the arbitrations themselves. And Levi's had one court reference that Judge Orrick treated as an arbitration for purposes of analysis. That was the only non-mediation that Levi's had had in the preceding 5 years.
Monster Energy is a somewhat of an outlier decision to begin with. The dissent in Monster Energy had a number of interesting points to make about what was wrong with the approach, but I understand that Monster Energy is still the law of the Ninth Circuit. But as we apply that outlier law, do we have any obligation to try to limit its reach? How does that work?
I think there's several ways to look at that. The first is, under Ninth Circuit case law, the prior dealings have to be disclosed if they are such that they give a reasonable impression of bias. And so I think here, if you put into context, the attorneys for Aqua Dynamics at Nixon Peabody and Morris, Polich, and Purdy had over 130 engagements with JAMS in the preceding 5 years. And so Levi's had a tiny fraction of that. And so if you're looking at just within that context, the number, the impact of those numbers of dealings that Levi's had is not such that would bring a reasonable belief of inherent bias in favor of Levi's over Aqua Dynamics.
What about the attorneys for Levi's?
The attorneys for Levi's had I don't know the exact number. It was less than Nixon Peabody. I know that. It was considerably less. I don't know the exact number. I think I answered your question.
Yes.
Do you think these questions of, for example, triviality is a question of law or a question of fact?
I believe it's a question of fact because you're applying what the law is and looking at the number of dealings and determining whether or not it is trivial or not. And I think even if you look at it as a question of fact or as a matter of law, because the number of dealings we have here are such a tiny fraction of what we had in Monster Energy, and there's not a repeat player bias at play, that either as a question of fact or as a matter of law, that the district court's opinion
should be. Why do you think there's not a repeat player bias? I mean, if you've had 9 contacts or 7 contacts with somebody, why doesn't that make you a repeat player?
If you look at the period of time that the Monster Energy Court was looking at, it was 5 years before the inception of the arbitration. And so if Monster Energy, as my opposing counsel had said, Monster Energy's forced the disclosure of JAMS in this case immediately after that case was done. And so had they made that disclosure the day that this arbitration was instituted, it would have disclosed 2 mediations and 1 court reference. And so at that point, you'd have those 3 connections. One of those had already been disclosed because of Judge Ware's involvement in it. So you'd only have 1 undisclosed mediation and 1 undisclosed court appointment.
But did Monster Energy say anything about only doing a 5-year look back?
That was the period that was irrelevant in that case. They did not.
Right, but they didn't say that's the only period that would be relevant. Right?
Right. They didn't say as a matter of law that that was the period that you were looking at. No.
Do you think that Judge Orrick actually held it against your friends on the other side because they asked for the JAMS arbitration?
That was a part of his opinion. I'm not sure what Your Honor means by
that. Yeah, was that a factor?
Yes.
Okay.
He said it was relevant, but not dispositive.
Okay, and why is that relevant? Because you can ask for all kinds of things and still not know that you're not being told about potential conflicts.
I think that it is relevant here because of the posture of the case. Is Monster Energy phrased it over and over again, that the disclosures are important when you have a repeat player against a one-off player. And a lot of the arbitrations come up where you have exactly this, like a form contract, where one party is compelling opponent after opponent after opponent to the same arbitrable body. And then becomes a repeat player there, becomes a normal customer there. And Monster Energy was literally one arbitration per month, more about 1.5 arbitrations per month for a 5-year period. Whereas in Levi's, you have only the 2 undisclosed engagements prior to the inception of this arbitration, and then 4 or 5 for the 5-year period after. So it does not go up to that magnitude. That, again, under the Ninth Circuit ruling, it has to show the apparent bias of one party over the other. And under Monster Energy, those limited engagements do not rise to that level.
And I just want to ask you the question that I asked your friend on the other side, and that is, where's the line? Okay, 97, clearly that's too much. And now we've got 7, and you're saying that's not enough. So where's the line get drawn?
Well, in terms of that, there's one district court case, but the Pacelli versus Vein Line Bunkering, and it's in our briefs at 2021 Westlaw 303-8641. That's one another case, and they looked at a case of 6 mediations prior to that arbitration, and they found that that was not significant enough to rise to the level under
Monster
Energy.
Okay, so what is the, so that's 6.
Mm-hmm, that's 6.
Where's the line? Is it 15? Is it 20? Is it 30?
I think the line is when you look at the Ninth Circuit case law, and it says if it's sufficient to show that the arbitral body would be inherently biased in favor of one party and over the other. And so here, if you look at in contact, the very small number of engagements that Levi's had over that long period of time, comparing it to the number of engagements that counsel had had, that Aqua Dynamics counsel has had, there is no reasonable inference or reasonable belief that arbitrable body would have been favored Levi's over Aqua Dynamics based on those limited prior engagements.
So while 7 you believe is not enough in this case, you don't preclude the idea that it could be enough in another case, because, for example, what if it were 7 arbitrations within a year of that, you know, showing a new relationship with a party that was sort of the promise of an enormous amount of new business? That might be a different set of facts that could, so it's possible 7 touch points could be enough, depending on what they were and the extent of time they arise over.
Yes, I would agree with that. Given
that's why it feels very factual to me, mm-hmm. this conclusion. I don't see how it could be a legal question.
Yes, I think with that, Your Honor, 7 arbitrations, given the amount of the distinction between a mediation and an arbitration, that would be the case. And here, in the court appointment, there is nothing in the record that establishes its duration, its magnitude, or the amount of money that JAMS got from that appointment. You know, the figures that were in Aqua Dynamics' brief were speculative. There's nothing.
Well, yeah, but who has access to that information?
In Monster Energy, the party challenging the arbitration subpoenaed JAMS and asked for that. In this case, Aqua Dynamics did not subpoena JAMS. They did not conduct discovery. They did not take any. There was an open district court case. They didn't take any discovery in that case at all. They just simply got the disclosures from JAMS and then filed the briefs on that.
To Judge Moore's point, you actually cite, and I don't know why you're not pointing her to this, but you cite cases in your brief that say that a question of triviality is one that should be reviewed for clear error. If it's clear error, then it's got to be factual, right?
I believe so, Your Honor, yes.
Anything further, counsel?
Not unless you have other questions.
No.
Thank you.
Mr. Michaels, I'll restore 2 minutes of rebuttal time.
Mr. Michael, I agree with the notion that the fact that Aqua insisted on arbitration with JAMS is irrelevant to the final decision as to whether there was adequate belief that these people were biased. But help me remember the record. Had Aqua had prior experience in mediations with JAMS?
Your Honor, I believe that Aqua disclosed that it had one prior mediation with JAMS.
And I'm using mediation or arbitration in the.
I believe it was a mediation.
But they had been used, they had used JAMS at a prior time.
Yes, and it had been, I'm sorry, I think what had been disclosed in the initial disclosures was that Aqua had not had any contact with JAMS. Or with the, in the initial disclosures, what was at issue was the three arbitrators, not JAMS as an entity. And at that point, there were no Aqua connections, I believe. I know it's in the record. When the later disclosures were made that covered the connections with JAMS as a whole, at that point, I believe it was disclosed that there was one mediation.
That JAMS had prior connections with?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
So I'd like to address very quickly the standard of review issue. The primary case that the appellee cites for that proposition is Employers Insurance of Wausau versus National Union Fire Insurance. And there, what the court does is it looks at the underlying, what was the connection between the arbitrator and the party. And the court says things like, it appears to have been brief, entailing only a couple hours of work. They say that copies of documents had been submitted. They say that they believed the arbitrator to be impartial and that they believe he formulated no fixed opinions or definite conclusions. I would submit that those are the decision that someone had formulated no fixed opinions or definite conclusions, that might be a matter of fact. But the legal significance of that, the legal significance of the arbitrator not formulating those opinions or conclusions, would be a question of law subject to de novo review.
Okay, anything further? Okay, thank you, counsel. We thank both counsel. This case is taken under submission.
Thank you.